Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. Last week, we discussed the legacy of Charles Schulz and his iconic Peanuts comic strip. This week, Glory Edom, founder of Well-Read Black Girl Book Club, discusses her essay anthology with fellow writer Charlene Carruthers. This conversation was recorded November 5th, 2018, live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hi, folks. How are we doing tonight? Welcome. Thanks for coming to the American Writers Museum. My name is Carrie Cranston. I'm the president here, and we are excited about tonight's program. All good stories have this in common. They make you realize you aren't alone. When the founders of this museum set out to determine who should be included in it, they assembled lists of writers from all across the country, all genders, genres, ethnicities, and traditions to create a place where everyone could see themselves in literature and recognize their experiences and values. Tonight, we welcome Glory Edom, whose anthology, Well-Read Black Girl, is a similar celebration of that recognition. What began as a book club, then spiraled upward into an online community of thousands and a book festival, and is now this recently published volume. This book amplifies the voices of Black women in all their power and skill. Glory has worked as a creative strategist for over 10 years at startups and cultural institutions, including Kickstarter and the New York Foundation for the Arts. She'll be interviewed tonight by Charlene Carruthers, whose book, Unapologetic, A Black, Queer, and Feminist Mandate for Radical Movements, has been called a rousing call for collective liberation. And she will be at Seminary Co-op on Wednesday night at 6 p.m. So if you want to see her there, go back and see her then. As the founding national director of BYP 100, she has worked alongside hundreds of young Black activists to build a member-led organization of 18 to 35-year-olds dedicated to creating justice and freedom for all Black people, and we welcome you both. Go ahead, ladies. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh my gosh. Let me tell y'all how excited I am to be here with Glory. I think I sent a text message based, will you be my friend, yes or no? because Glory is this the embodiment of what it means to love Black women and girls. And so I'm just super honored to be here with you and to celebrate you and to talk about this bomb book. It's amazing. And so we're going to get right into it. And Glory's going to gift us with reading an excerpt.
Yes. Awesome. Thank you. That was an amazing introduction. And it is true. She sent me a text message and I said yes, followed by gifts of Oprah and Beyonce. It was very simple. I want to thank everyone for being here this evening. I'm really honored. I see some familiar faces, even some online faces, some hearts in here. So I'm going to begin by reading from the introduction. And it kind of just tells why I started this and how this all began. When I was a freshman at Howard University in Washington, D.C., I worked as a reading instructor at Maya Angelou Public Charter School. I was drawn to the school because of its namesake. I had already read Angelou's 1969 autobiography, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, twice by then. The first time was rather theatrically in the seventh grade. I recited the chapters aloud to my unassuming baby brother, Maurice. We both stumbled through the coming-of-age story and understood little of the childhood trauma she encountered. Yet I read it intently because I was intrigued by the relationship between Maya and her brother Bailey. At 12 years old, I was seeking myself in her story, looking for parallels in our childhoods. The second reading happened when I was much older. I was 19 and fully aware of Maya Angelou's legacy. I knew she had been San Francisco's first Black female street conductor at the age of 16. I knew she had been close friends with James Baldwin and worked with Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. She was iconic, a civil rights activist, dancer, actress, journalist, and of course, the world-renowned author. This time, Angelou's distinct voice was clear in my head, and her words resonated in a visceral way. As I read about her childhood in Stamps, Arkansas, my tears flowed endlessly. I cried for her pain and for her triumphs. The relentlessness of racism that plagued her childhood. The sexual abuse she suffered. The way literature helped her regain her voice when all seemed lost. After reading her memoir, something in my heart and mind clicked and forever changed me. I suddenly understood what her story, excuse me, I suddenly understood that her story was part of a larger story of Black womanhood and survival. She wrote openly about injustice, celebrated Black motherhood, criticized racism in the Jim Crow South, and fought for her own personal freedom. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings is a powerful story of self-definition. Maya Angelou and the rest of the inspiring authors I've encountered throughout my life have taught me that, as Black women, we define ourselves for ourselves. When you tell us we can't, we simply resist and defy expectations. Our stories are filled with love, strength, and resilience. We are not looking for anyone else to give us validation because we have one another. We celebrate one another. We have a tenacity and grace that is unparalleled. In Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, she writes, "We had defended ourselves since memory against everything and everybody, considered all speech a code to be broken by us, and all gestures subject to careful analysis. We had become headstrong, devious, and arrogant. Nobody paid us any attention, so we paid very good attention to ourselves. Our limitations were not known to us, not then. We Black women writers have always had to take good care of ourselves, creating our own limitless boundaries. Whether we explore taboos, stereotypes, the idea of love, or the literary canon itself, we are writing ourselves into the spaces that neglect or ignore us. Headstrong, a necessary quality to withstand the losses and celebrate the victories. I created Well-Read Black Girl because I wanted to develop a creative space where Black women's voices could be centered. Storytelling is an extension of our sisterhood. From the beginning, I've dedicated WRBG to the Black women on our bookshelves. Yet it is also a call to action for Black women to freely define their own narratives on their own terms. Like Morrison states in Beloved, definitions belong to the definer, not the defined. I wanted to build on the radical notion that Black women can read, write, and be whatever and whomever they desire."
Thank you.
So, Glory, you have built a phenomenal platform to, you know, highlight the stories and skill, I think, and craft of so many Black women across this country with so many different stories. And you could have made a choice to write a book that didn't have other writers in it, right? You didn't have to write an anthology. So I'm not going to ask you why you chose to write an anthology. What I'm going to ask is, do you see yourself in these stories? Mm-hmm. How do you see yourself at all? And was it important for you to see yourself in the stories that are in this anthology?
Yeah, yes. I mean, that's a great question. I do see myself in every story, and I really see a reflection of myself in every author. Working on this anthology was just like a life-changing experience because it reminded me of how human people are. When you have to like edit Jesmyn Ward or Jacqueline Woodson and you see their mistakes, it's just, and they're not big ones by any means. They're like, so they'll be beyond talented, but the fact that they are like us in a way where they have to put everything on the page and correct it and edit it. And like, it made me feel like a kinship with them because they trusted me to even see their words and their potential of the mistakes and how the work, you know, how it gets made. I just imagine that, you know, Jesmyn Ward did one draft of, you know, Salvage the Bones and it was perfect. And that's not like how it works. You know, there is like a process and there's a grace to even critiquing and loving each other in that way. Mm-hmm. And I could have, you know, done this in a way where it was me as an individual, but I really felt that the only reason I have the success that I do is because of the community. And I feel like everything I'm doing should be community driven because it's publishing. It's a collaborative space. You don't have a book. It isn't successful without its readers, you know? And I consider myself a very dedicated reader. Even before I put the word writer or editor in front of that, I'm just like, I'm a reader. And that's something I feel like I have strong expertise in, and everything else is new and I'm growing into that. But I can't even imagine what the beauty of this without it celebrating and being in like just in communion with these other writers, because that was the whole goal of Well Read Black Girl, to like celebrate and uplift the voices of writers. It's not glory. And I try to always say that, like, I'm excited and I am the cheerleader, but it's not just about me. It's like about everyone who wants to be a writer, who aspires, who's established. It's like really everyone who really dedicates themselves to like literature, especially mm-hmm. as a Black woman in the space where it's so limited at times.
That's right. That's right. And I actually want to talk about, like, as a writer, the structure of this book.
Yes.
Like, how did you arrive to, because I imagine that the book proposal looked very different from what this like ultimately resulted in. That's at least my assumption or my imagination. So could you tell us folks who have read it or haven't read it, about the structure and why you chose this particular structure and like how you broke down the sections?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because originally this was going, I really envisioned a photo book. I wanted it to be very similar to the Instagram page where it had, just like old vintage photos of these writers and quotes. I wanted it to feel very aspirational. But I really wanted the faces of the women. So I started doing the research, and I had a proposal, and it just really, things look different on Instagram when it comes to really finding the rights through all those photos and then trying to like have them. It's very expensive to be quite frank. And, it wasn't like landing the way I wanted it to as I was writing up the proposal and I was trying to do the research. Like I went to the Library of Congress and I went to the Schomburg. I was trying to figure out how to make it an actual like photo book. And when that wasn't, didn't go the way I planned, I went back and I asked a couple of my mentors. I talked to Tiari Jones and I talked to Renee Watson, both who are in the book. I told them about the idea and I was like, what else could I do? And I asked them if they'd be interested in possibly doing, writing an essay. And I thought about the questions, that I wanted to pose. And I really wanted it to be something that the writers could really explore. Like this idea of when you first, like, saw yourself, that really is just the origin story. And that's my favorite question to ask. Like, where did you start? And not just with this anthology, just in general, when I meet people, I'm like, what's your story? Like, cause I think that opens up people to tell, it could be something that happened to them last week, or it could be like when I was 5 years old, So I wanted it to be a very open-ended question. And I thought about my experience, like when I first really fell in love with books in a way that it went beyond just like being leisurely and became more like therapeutic. And that moment with Maya Angelou was like a really defining moment in my life to hear, to really understand her story. And it was like, for lack of a better, like a Oprah aha moment. It was really like, yeah, it was really like my, oh yeah, it was. It was like my very like open moment for me. And so I was curious about like, how did that feel for someone like Barbara Smith or like Jacqueline Woodson? Like, how did it feel for other people? And I definitely like workshopped it a lot. I spoke to my friends. I posed the questions to my best friends. I talked to my mom about it just to hear what the responses would be. And I shared with you too, like as we were talking, like I was afraid that everyone would say Toni Morrison, which is like excellent. This book could have been all Toni Morrison. Like I love her. But I was like, will the essays become repetitive? Will they have like the same flow, and that didn't happen. Everyone came with something like really completely fresh and new and unexpected. Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to do exactly what you just did and ask, like, what is your story? Because I know this is not about you, your words, but it is about you, because you made a choice on who to include and I imagine who not to include. In the book, you decided on the questions that would be asked for this. You did a couple of the Q&As in here. You wrote them out yourself. So who are you and who are your people?
Wow, that's such a good question. So my people, man, so I am first generation. Both my parents are Nigerian, and I was born here in the States, but I actually lived in Nigeria for 2 years. My dad, he studied here at Howard University, my alma mater as well. And the goal was he would come here, study architecture, and we would move back to Nigeria. So when my dad was like finishing college, my mom and I were back home, and I got really ill. So me getting sick changed the trajectory of everything. So my mom came back immediately and she stayed, and my parents eventually got divorced. My father moved back to Nigeria and me and my brother stayed here. So I spent summers in Nigeria, traveled back and forth. We would go there for holidays to see, stay with my dad. A lot of times I would, like, my dad was very much no TV, and you know, there, where my dad lives is like, did live is very remote. So it was lots of books. So I would just kind of like pack them up when I would go for summer vacations and for holidays and stuff. It would just be like lots of books. Like I remember reading Audre Lorde's Sister Outsider in Nigeria, wow. You know, so like I just would carry, that's where my like library and such started. So I am Nigerian American. So those are like my people, my roots. But I grew up in DC. So let me clarify, Arlington, Virginia, a suburb right outside of D.C. But my mom does live in D.C. proper now, but I grew up in Arlington, Virginia. And it's, you know, Arlington is very like multicultural neighborhood. It was, you know, I felt very comfortable telling people I was Nigerian. There was also this kind of disconnect at times where I would tell folks like where I was from and they would say like, oh, well, I thought you were black. And I'm like, I am black. you know, so there was this idea that my blackness like didn't match up completely in some spaces. And it wasn't until I went to Howard where like I really understood diaspora and this idea of like being from the Caribbean, but being from Chicago and being from DC, it's all the same. You know, it has like this richness that we're all like in this, you know, in the same pot. You know what I mean? But prior to that, I felt like I separated things a lot. Like I was, you know, one way at home. And then when I was at school, I was another way. And it wasn't until like my friends came over the house. They were like, what's that smell? Like, what's that? Like if my mom was like cooking like fufu or making a goosey soup or something, they'd be like, what is going on? Like, you know, and as I got older, I became more comfortable with those distinctions. I became more proud of like where my parents are from, the fact that I had the privilege to travel back and forth. And I can understand our native dialect, but I don't speak it, you know? So that was also something that like I struggled with, like my cousins and even my younger brothers, they speak our native language. And I know they're just like really fluent in languages. My brother also speaks like Spanish and Japanese. Like I'm just like the one like, I don't know what you guys are saying. That's like where I come from. That's like Nigeria and being from DC, being from this very like multicultural space, this very like metropolitan area where there's so many different types of folks, that reside in Arlington and DC. And then I went to Howard because my dad went there, you know, so I was very much like a daddy's girl and I wanted to go to the same school that he went to. And so I ended up at the Mecca at Howard University, which is like, you know, I talk about it here. It was just a very defining moment for me.
How so?
Just because, again, like I learned how to be my best self and like really celebrate my blackness in a way that I didn't feel like I had to compare myself to anyone else or feel like there's any like reservation in my identity. Whereas in other spaces, sometimes that would happen. Like Arlington, it is multicultural, but there's still like times where like everyone kind of still wants to be the same. And Howard just kind of like pushed all that away. And then I like graduated and I was like, oh, I'm back in the real world. And there's this idea that we have this almost like this huge sorority of people isn't always going to exist. And with me trying to curate this community and create Well Wear Black Girl, it's a lot of times I feel like I'm replicating the experience I had in college.
You know. So tell us about the well-read black girl community, right?
Yes.
Like what's most exciting about it?
Yeah.
How did you get this? Did you know that it was going to get this big?
No, not at all. You know? I could have never predicted that I'd be like sitting here talking to you, have an anthology. Like I wouldn't never, ever, ever. I mean, I've had lots of different ideas and no, I wouldn't like, it just didn't happen that way. Also, I think some people may know the story, but it really started, I think of the story really, it's like extension of black love too. So my partner he also went to Howard University with me and we've known each other since our freshman year of college. And you know, we're close friends. And then, you know, we started dating when our senior year and, he made me the shirt. He made me the shirt that said well-read black girl. And that was the, like a gift that he'd given to me for my birthday. And I didn't, you know, really think of it. It was more like an inside joke between us. And when I was wearing it out in the public and people were asking me questions or just like, hey, they just wanted to know where you, where'd you get the shirt from? Right.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, my boyfriend made it, you know? And then outside, when that was passed, it was like, so what are you reading? Like, what are you reading right now? And I typically in New York, I always have like a book in my bag and I would pull it out and I would really have these like great conversations on the train with folks. Like I am a talkative person naturally, but it just kept happening so many times that I felt like something was like really special about it. And it was a really vulnerable time for me too, because I was new to New York. I really didn't have any friends. So like a sister girl sitting next to me and being like, oh, what, like, what's up? Like, where's your shirt from? Where's your shoes from? Where's the book from? Like, it just was like really comforting.
Who does your hair?
Yeah. Who does your hair? Like, yeah, just like conversation. And I was already yearning that. I was like, I need to be around black women. My best friends don't live in New York. Like I was already in a space where I was eager for that kind of connection. So the fact that folks were coming up to me voluntarily, starting conversation. And you know, that doesn't happen often, especially like as you get older. Like it's not like you're just making friends randomly on the street. You know what I mean? So for that, it just felt really special. And so I went back and I sat with it for a little bit and I talked to OPO and I was like, well, you know, what do you think I should do? Like, should I sell t-shirts? Right. And, he's like, no, you know, like, what if you like started a book club? And I was like, yeah, I think like that'd be a fun idea. So I started it really small thinking, that it would just be me and my girlfriends and just like really small, not thinking like, oh, it would be this whole thing. Mm-hmm. But I do have a background in like marketing and mm-hmm. social media. And I thought it would be fun to like create like a social media thing. I was going to be really happy if I had like 100 followers. Like seriously, I was like, okay, if I have like 100 followers, that'd be really cool. And I didn't follow like Bookstagram and I don't really even do Goodreads like that. You know what I mean? Like uh-huh. I do, like, I'm just like, I was like, oh, like this seems cool. It could be fun to do things.
I'm just looking at the count.
Oh yeah.
It's 151,000. Oh. You know, and I was like, that's amazing.
It's really crazy. But I mean, it's not even like Kim Kardashian level, but it's still very significant.
I mean, you know.
So it just started happening. Like I kind of thought about what I do for like my 9-to-5. Like I do a lot of like social media and branding things, and I brought that energy towards it. And I really thought about what if I was like a little more intentional about the gatherings and how I like host things. And my friends will tell you, like, I'm the one like to plan Christmas parties and like do the white elephant. Like with hosting events comes very naturally to me. So it wasn't like a big extension to like have a book club, because I already do those things. But the real turning point from like t-shirt to conversation to like this was when I invited Naomi Jackson. So we did like a test book club and we read Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, and that went really well. Actually, men and women came. Like I remember my friend Nisa was there. She brought her, like her boyfriend, who's like now her husband. Like, we just hung out. And then the next book I was reading was The Stars Died of Bird Hill. And I went to see Naomi at, Greenlight at the bookstore, and I had my Instagram on my shoulder. I had, maybe had like 60 people, and I was like, I have this book club. It's on Instagram. I was like, well, would you come, you know, talk to us? Like, there'll be like 10 people there, which there were like, you know, 10, maybe 8, 10 people. And, she said yes. I think Naomi's like now a very close friend, and I thank her so much for that, saying that yes, because I feel like that's what shifted everything. So from that yes, I decided that it would focus on, because we read Ta-Nehisi Coates the first time. So we then decided we would focus on black women, and we would focus on debut authors. Like sometimes I don't know if everyone realizes that the book, there's always a debut author. So it's like the time you need support, you need people to buy your book, you need people to show up in the room to be like, we got you. We're excited for you to have the autograph. Like it's such a perfect time for a new author because they need that additional support. So Naomi was a new author. It was her first book. And she was like, yeah, sure. I'll come. And fun fact, she's good friends with Natalie Diaz. She brought Natalie Diaz with her to the book club. Natalie Diaz is a Native American poet who just won the MacArthur Genius Award. which I was like, and I didn't know that at the time. And so she came, she brought her friend Natalie. We talked, she read to us. We did it in the back of a bar. And again, my like boyfriend, I like, he's really wonderful. And he recorded it. He was like, I'll record it for you guys. So he did like the first three and then like you see no more videos because he was like, you're getting too big. So he was like, yeah, I'll record it for you. Again, it really reminded me of college because I was a journalism major. He was a film major. So he used to do my little like, welcome to WHBC. You know, he used to do my videos for me. So he was like, yeah, I'll record it. And, you know, it was this whole thing. So the energy was there. We had such a good time. And Naomi introduced me to our second or like third book club pick, which was The Turner House, Angela Flournoy.
Love that book.
Yeah, Detroit, like Turner House, if you guys haven't read it, it's an excellent book. So again, it was like this domino effect of like, oh, who else do you want to meet? And then someone else was like, oh, you should read Britt Bennett. You know Britt? Oh yeah, she has this new book called The Mother's coming out. Email exchange. And then like publishers and publicists started getting wind of like what I was doing. Cause even, I was even expecting that. Like I was like really excited to be in contact with the authors. And then like, so I think with Britt, they were like, oh, you should go through my publicist. And I was like, publicist? I was like, I just want you to come to this thing. So then it started like taking a shape that it felt like more formal and I had to like write a nicely worded email and, but all that to say, it just was really organic and like it just kept like growing because of the introductions and just the energy behind it. And even, you know, most recently I've been more vocal about like, hi, my name is Glory. But even before that, it took me like a really long time to go, like I would just show a picture of the book and it would be really about the author. And it still is. It's like about the author because that's the whole point.
But curators have so much power. Right? Whoever curated this museum, like, they're going to influence the thousands of people who move through this space. And I see you as a powerful curator, right, of content. And I say all the time, I even put it in my book. I was like, I don't feel as well read as most people that I know. I say that all the time. I know. Honestly, reading this and it flipped the script, my internal script, because I'm very well read in fiction, very, very well read in like various literature by Black women, Black folk, all kinds of like people who aren't necessarily like, I can't break down all of the things that Karl Marx wrote, right? But I can tell you like about, I don't know, Toni Morrison or Octavia Butler's or any Pearl Cleage's like entire catalog kind of thing. And so for me, like this gives me a lot of inspiration as someone who's always felt a way about my own well-readness in political spaces, right? But this book to me is inherently political. Like if you gather a bunch of Black women, because this is not well-read women of color girls or girls of color. It's not the well-read girls of color book. It is the well-read Black girl book. And so much of what I read in here, as a Black feminist, like it just deeply resonates with me. And I'm not one to believe that you have to like slap the Black feminist label on you for you to actually do Black feminist work. And so there are two like major themes that I pulled out of the book and want to go into. One is around protection and specifically whose essay? I have like dog ears in this book. It's in Barbara Smith's Triple OG Barbara Smith.
Yeah, which I like when she said yes. I was like, Miss Smith, are you sure you can? You, Miss Smith? Like I was.
She don't be saying yes.
Yeah, she does not say a lot. So I was so grateful. Like literally, anytime someone said yes to me, I was like, thank you, thank you so much. Like it was.
The people you have in this book is just phenomenal. And Barbara Smith, when she began writing publicly about Black feminism, like as a Black lesbian, she talked about how dangerous it was for her at that time. And she says in the essay, for the first time, after reading Go Tell It on the Mountain by James Baldwin, she says, for the first time, there was no need to protect myself from the characters in the book. And so I'm curious, like, what books do you find solace in or safety, or do you feel
like protected and like safe in reading?
Yeah, that's a great question. I also want to kind of go back to the word curator because I feel sensitive to that word because, curation is, I feel like everyone uses that now with social media, but it's such a thing that it's like very studied and well researched. Like I know folks who have like their PhDs in creation. So like, so for me to do it on Instagram, I'm like, it is one thing. I think of myself as an enthusiast and an advocate, and I feel like I have good taste, you know? So I don't like, I try to like stay away from the word curator.
Okay.
But in terms of like the things that I return to over and over, I really love short stories. Mm. And so I read a lot of Alice Walker. I love her short story collection, In Love and Trouble. Mm. It's my favorite essay is Everyday Use. Because I love the feeling of short stories. I feel like parables where they kind of like give you a message. It feels concise. I love Zizi Packer. Drinking Coffee Elsewhere is like the truth. I feel like that's like still feels like a very relevant essay collection. You can pick it up now and has like that timelessness to it. What else do I read? I mean, as I was doing the research for this, I returned over and over again to Toni K. Mbara, Gorilla My Love, a Black Woman, the anthology, like looking at and studying the craft of it, Homegirls, Barbara Smith. Like I really looked at all these collections and see how they curated it and looked at the types of essays and poetry they decided to include. At one point I was debating and putting some like sonnets in it. But then I felt like it was going in a little bit of a different direction. Maybe that's another project. and I read things in different parts of my life too. Like, you know, the things that I read when I was in high school or even college, they feel different. You know, I know I look really young, but I am in my 30s.
Hopo. So am I.
We look good. And so like when I read things now, I'm just like, okay, like how does this, it feels almost like a bookmark on my life to see like what I thought when I was Howard and when I read, cause I've, at this point I've read The Bluest Eye maybe like 6 times.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Or I've tried, like and now I'm like reading in a different way. So because I'm writing more, I'm looking more at structure. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the craft of the story. You know, what happens in the first 10 pages? Like, how does it get to its like essence, that's you know? Right. Whereas before I think I just was like reading in a very emotional way. Mm. People often ask me like how I do the book selections, and it really is like if it makes me laugh or if it makes me cry, you know? If a book like has me like feeling tight in my chest, like I know it's a good book. If I feel that suspense or I feel just emotionally drawn to it. I also feel like I pull a lot of inspiration from other genres. I go to theater a lot. Like I've watched a lot of plays. Lynn Nottage is in this book because of that reason. I've always been obsessed with her and like From Ruin to Sweat. I think she's doing a whole series at Signature this year that I'm like super excited to see. And I also worked a little in theater right after college. So I try to look for like intersections across genres just to get inspiration from. And like, I think the page serves as a guide, whether it's a book or a play or even music, like it just is how the story flows. I'm trying to think what else. Nikki Giovanni.
Yeah. Is there anything or anyone that we will be surprised that you read them or this book is something that, that's your jam?
Well, I think like some of the, I actually read a lot of plays too. Mm-hmm. Like I really love Susie Laurie Parks. Even in the examples that I gave with the short stories with Alice Walker and Zizi mm-hmm. Packer, I think I'm really drawn to dialogue. Mm-hmm. Like I like I like when I'm reading a book and it feels like, oh, you know what? Someone would say that in real life. Mm-hmm. You know, some like stories sometimes can feel like really lyrical, but I love like when it's just a like, good character dialogue when people are talking back and forth and there's like a rhythm to it. Mm-hmm. And you know, I also really love like nonlinear stories, like White Teeth, Zadie Smith. Mm. I love how that like, the format of that story. Maybe this might be unexpected, but I love Catch 22. That's like one of my favorite books. Barbara King's Oliver, like I love Poisonwood Bible, and those kind of all like follow the same like non-linear stories with a splashback and mirror memories. It kind of goes all over the place, mm-hmm. and then at the end there's like a full like resolution. Mm. Yeah, and it, now that I say that a lot, it's just like it's probably how my that's how my brain is. I'm just kind of like, and then the end, you know, like I kind of like jump around different places, mm-hmm. and then. Awesome. Somehow everything comes together at the end.
The resolution.
Yeah, there's resolution at the end. Yeah.
So I have another section in here mm-hmm. that I want to ask you about, but I'm going to ask an impossible question. I'm going to say it's an impossible question to answer, but I'm asking it because I imagine that there are aspiring writers in the room. Like there's somebody in here who has an idea, you haven't written it yet, and hopefully by the end of this evening, you're gonna do it. There's some typewriters over here if you need to get started, you know. What makes good writing?
Oh, well, that is a difficult question. Mm-hmm. Okay, so again, through this process of writing this, and you know, watching the people that I consider masters, how they do their work, like no one is above edits. And I think it's less about the you know, quality per se of the writing, but just like the how intensely you are open to critique and changing and like being able to like develop your voice. I was really just amazed at the generosity between all the contributors who are clearly established in their craft, that they like really extended themselves and took my advice and took like my edits, you know? So like, and something about that just like felt like really humbling. Like they're like really, you know, involved in this exchange and taking the tips and the, you know, the line edits that I'm doing very like gently, cause I'm like nervous, you know, I had a lot of anxiety going through it, but then I had to basically buckle down and say like, this is my book. This is, you know, I am the editor. I have to be really like, mm-hmm. I have to be steadfast with this and not like waver and not be too overly nervous. Cause even in this situation here, this is a really exciting, but I am nervous cause it all just feels new to me. And I'm used to kind of like being behind the scenes mm-hmm. with things. I think like good writing really has a rhythm to it. And the things that I enjoy have a level of like vulnerability, where you can tell the person is really like putting themselves on the page and they're sharing like intimate details. I've read a couple of them, like right now I've been thinking about writing a particular moment in my life that is really hard for me. And the best advice I got was like, you know, write the thing that you're like most afraid of.
Yeah.
You know, like really write. Did you tell me that?
I don't know.
Oh. Okay.
I don't know. I'm having flashbacks in this moment of my own life.
I was like, you gotta say that. Okay. But yeah, like really write the thing that you're most, mm-hmm. most afraid of and put it there and like, sit with it.
Yeah.
And I say that a lot because a lot, like we're in a space where, especially with social media and like living in New York, there always feels like a sense of urgency. Like if I can like sit with the discomfort of what I've written and process it, then I know it will be good. Cause if I'm feeling this discomfort, this means like that emotion will be transferred to the reader, I'm hoping. Mm. And so as I'm like start trying to really like unpack this difficult moment in my life and write about it, I'm like, I have to be like unafraid of that feeling and that discomfort. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where like good writing, and that's why my litmus test is for me is good is still like my emotional response. Mm. Cause it's like, oh, like I felt it. I really, really felt it. I've always been that way. Like even when I was little, you know, like if I would have an outburst, it was because like, I'm like, but you know, Boy Meets World, he fell. And you know, I would just have these like feelings where I would just like, I would really feel it like in a visceral way. And I also think it keeps me honest, and it also like keeps me like, I'm being intuitive, mm-hmm. you know, and not just kind of like being performative or saying things. It's just like, it's like, oh, I really feel this.
That's right. When if y'all get a chance, they're right around the corner. There's a quote from Octavia Butler mm-hmm. and James Baldwin around like the writing process. And like Octavia just shuts it down and says, you think you good at the beginning. And you probably not, but you have to do it over and over and over and over again. And that's how you become good.
Right.
And so I'm excited to see what you do next, because I do believe that great writers, people who write well, read a lot.
Yeah.
Read a lot. And so my last question before we open it up to everyone else is around the theme of invisibility that I think is present and discussed throughout the book. And there is an essay or a piece in here by Mahogany L. Brown.
Yes, I love Mahogany.
And I don't know Mahogany, but I imagine Mahogany's voice when I read this. You know, and now I need to like actually look it up.
Oh, she has a wonderful voice. She's really? Like an amazing poet. Yeah.
Gosh, I just like read it in someone's voice. And in it, she writes, "In Sacramento, California, I was invisible everywhere I went. Brown skin, gap-toothed smile, unpetite, nappy hair, not funny or smart or enough of any one thing to fuss about. And so I found books." Yeah. And so I'd love to hear you talk about what this book makes visible.
Right?
Like what's particularly around what's been rendered invisible and how this book makes things visible.
What I'm so excited about is like this book really affirms that we do need reflections of ourselves, and they're not simply just platitudes that we say that, like, you know, we need more diversity, we need these things in schools, like we need to have representation. Like, we really do need to do it because it heals us and it allows us to see ourselves wholly. Like, I was surrounded by a lot of different people as a young person, but I still did not realize what I was missing because it wasn't provided for me. I was talking to students earlier today, and I asked if anyone had read Gloria Naylor. No one raised their hand, but everyone's read To Kill a Mockingbird. And, you know what I mean? So like these like simple things where there's no question that these stories are important and that they have craftsmanship and they need to be read and told and like really cherished, but they're not even being put in front of us. And when it's invisible on the bookshelf, you can't see yourself, and you can't even realize that that's something you could aspire to or feel accepted, you know? And because of that, like, I was like reading things that I loved. Like, I loved like Little Women, and I loved Wuthering Heights. I read all these things, but the moment I read Maya Angelou, it's like, that's when like that shift happened. Cause I was like, oh, this is me. And not necessarily in a literal way, but it was something that I was like, this person read, cause I kind of do the similar thing. Like, I read aloud a lot. And as I was reading her aloud, I was like, this sounds like my mom, you know? And then later on when I was older, I don't go into this in the, in this story, but my mom suffered from a severe depression. And from about the time I was like 19 to the time I was about 22, she was selectively mute. So she literally didn't speak. And so with Maya Angelou, I felt like that same kinship, because that something happened to her very young too. When she was 5, she experienced a trauma and she stopped speaking. And so Maya Angelou, my mother, like didn't speak for the same amount of years, right? 5 years. And as like when that happened, we had a process of communicating. We would like write letters to one another, and like she was like, she needed treatment. And if my mother walked into the room now, like, you would never know this happened. She's like healed and in such a beautiful place. And our family has really overcome that. But at that time, I wasn't like going to books just because like it was something to do or even to see a reflection. Like, I needed that. Like, I needed the like support, and I was like looking for like advice in terms of like becoming a young woman, like trying to understand my mother's pain and her grief. I was like trying to like put words into my life in a way so I could feel a sense of the, back to that word, like resolution and calmness, you know? So it's not just about like, oh, we need diversity. Like, sometimes people really need healing. Like, they need that. Like, you need someone to tell you. When I read Bell Hooks and she tells me about what solidarity means or what it means to be a Black feminist, that's a real thing that I'm applying to my practical life. It's not just something I'm like putting this on Instagram, you know? So I like write down these things, and I read these quotes, and I read these books to really try to find ways to apply them in my like personal life. And I feel like the women that I encounter, and I'm sure a lot of women in this room do the same things. I feel like, I know you do the same thing. Like, you are reading these things to better yourself. and to be like a stronger, viable, more present person in the world. Maybe it's because I'm a Capricorn too. I don't know. I do try to like take everything I'm reading and apply it and be, really just be generous with that too. Cause I feel like a lot of the work that I'm doing now, like I feel like I'm a resource. So I didn't get an MFA. I didn't necessarily study publishing, in school, but now that I have access to it and I'm just really trying to pay it forward and help people with the resources I do have.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so welcome. Much. Can we please give Gloria a round of applause? Awesome. Yes. So good. So good.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, we will talk to Catherine Arnold about her book, Pandemic 1918, Eyewitness Accounts from the Greatest Medical Holocaust in Modern History. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.